Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Horrible Podcast. I'm Brian.
I'm Tyler.
And I'm Drew.
What are you doing back there? Just a reminder, everybody, we remind you this every week, but we are on all sorts of social media. On Twitter, we're the Horrible PCast, HORRORBULLPCAST. On Facebook and Google, we're just the Horrible Podcast. That's Google Plus for all you lovers out there. And you can just go to thehorriblepodcast.com. That's where you can find us.
This is our NPR episode.
This is our, yeah.
And I feel like we're like late night drive.
sending this one out to all you 80s lovers out there. Tonight's episode.
Turn your bass down a little. You're so bassy.
You are
you're like, the Barry White of the podcast. Turn the bass down a little
Basie.
Bit. So yeah, we're all over social media. Just search for the Horrible Podcast. Yeah, the main thing is rate and review the podcast on iTunes. That's the thing we're really looking for these days is reviews. So if you take a minute, just pop out your phone when you stop driving, listening to the podcast. Just click on it, go over to iTunes app, and just type something. This podcast is awesome. 5 stars. Boom. Done.
Or if you want to us to just take that guesswork out of it for you, tweet us your Apple ID and password, and we will do it for you.
Yeah,
we will not. I promise I will not buy everything on my wish list with your Apple ID.
Yeah, just a couple things. Like a thing here, thing there. Like, we won't go crazy. Just, yeah, tweet. Right. Yeah.
And I'm not even going to buy the movie. I'll just rent it. So it's like you'll get $4.99, not $19.
There's an understanding is what we're saying.
Right. I'm not going to abuse that privilege.
Right, right.
So that trust is good. It's safe with you.
I'm telling you what I'm going to do. You know what you're going to get into. Hey, we decided to dig into the classics for since it's October.
Into the vault.
For Halloween.
We're doing this episode Friday the 13th.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wait, which one?
1980, Friday the 13th.
Okay.
You know, there's a silent movie version. I mean, there's not a version, but there's a movie called Friday the 13th from like 1922.
I found that out
yesterday. Yeah, just by typing it into, I think, Rotten Tomatoes, it just popped up.
Is this part of the trivia you were telling us
no,
about?
No, this is not. This is separate. That's just a bonus.
Gotcha.
So I was very tempted to watch another one, though, when I was putting it in. I was like, I don't want to watch Friday the 13th again. I want to watch another Friday the 13th.
Which one? Like, if you when you think
about a good title,
what? Another Friday the 13th.
Yeah, yeah.
Next Friday the 13th.
What? Yeah. Well, there isn't there a movie called What Did You Do Last Friday the 13th, or something?
I think I'm sure there was a parody.
Yeah, those parodies. I'm not sure what. I can't get all those titles straight.
So, if you had to pick, like, which one you like to watch? I mean, you say like, I don't want to watch this one. What's your go-to Friday movie?
I mean, that's the problem. I mean, I think that's the problem is that this one has been the go-to for so long that I would like to watch another one. Like, I always do, like anytime a Friday the 13th comes around, Gina and I always sit there and say, oh, we got to go home and watch the Friday the 13th. And by default, we just would always put in the first one until like a couple of Friday the 13ths ago. It's like, oh my God, I don't want to watch the first one again. We have eight of them. Can we just watch another one? And so we did that. You know, I mean, six has that, you know, that nice kitsch value to it. Where, you know, it starts to get a little meta for a little bit. Two, of course, has Jason. That's always nice. Three has the hockey mask. There are reasons to watch several others.
Wait, the first one doesn't have Jason in it?
Nope. Spoiler.
I didn't watch
well,
this movie.
Technically, yes, it does. Just
not as the killer.
Fair enough. That's true.
Originally, he was named Josh, and they thought that was not a scary enough name. That was too nice a name, so they changed the name to Jason later on.
It is cool to go and watch this again now, having seen all the Friday the 13th, you know, Freddy versus Jason, all the history that goes along with it, to go back and revisit it and know that at that point no one had any clue what the last name Voorhees meant and what it would mean for like horror for the last 34 years.
I always thought it was so cool when the Saved by the Bell credits would roll because Lisa Turtle's real name is Lark Voorhees.
Right.
And I was always like Jason Voorhees. God, I was such a nerd. Why would I even admit that on the internet?
You were the Screech of South Georgia.
I most certainly was. That's...
Well, it's like when she pronounces herself as, I'm Mrs. Voorhees. And this one, it doesn't land at all because it doesn't really, there's no reason for it to. initially, but I mean, it does now with us watching it. But I mean, but initially, you're like, all right, okay, old lady, that's fine, whatever.
Yeah, and like, you? What's
like, imagine the theater the first time. What did people care? And said, I'm Mrs. Voorhees. Like, all right,
this movie would have been a great like seventh movie because it would have landed, you know. And watching it now, I already knew who Jason was before I watched the first Friday the 13th because I'd seen most of the other ones first. Before right. I circle back around to the first one. So I understood implicitly who she was when she showed up on screen. But I can imagine how confused audiences were the first time they saw it. And this like middle-aged woman shows up in the last third of this movie.
I wouldn't even say the last third. I would say the last 10 minutes.
No, yeah. She's in the movie for like 27 minutes. She only has like 13 minutes of screen time, but she shows up like 23 with like 23 minutes left.
Okay.
Because that scene goes on forever, it feels like. So anyway,
also maybe the longest making coffee scene ever.
Yeah. Perchance.
So Friday the 13th came out in 1980, 2 years after Halloween, which I would argue that the town that dreaded sundown, I know I talked to you about this earlier, was kind of was probably the start of the whole slasher. I mean, in Friday the 13th Part 2, Jason's even dressed almost in the same outfit as the guy from the town that dreaded sundown.
Yeah, almost exactly. Like, I mean, the thing about Friday the 13th is that I still like that movie, but it is a blatant ripoff of everything that came before it. And they have readily admitted that, yes, we were just trying to cash in. Like, Sean Cunningham has admitted, the producer and director has admitted, yeah, we kind of ripped off Halloween.
Oh, because the POV camera the whole time. Yeah. It's, you know, there. And also, too,
go ahead.
Ask a second.
No, but the... And even though we hold up Friday the 13th basically a classic horror film, they did steal a lot.
Iconic.
Okay. it's not a universal classic monster, but just like even the score is taken, almost sounds note for note from Psycho if you listen to it.
What's weird about this series though is that it takes from so many things but then became iconic itself. But because I like when I think about that movie, I still think of Harry Manfredini's like almost schizophrenic score for this. I think I actually love the score for this first movie a lot. I think some of the later ones get kind of tone deaf because they turn into like, I don't know, like disco music in the third one. But like in the it's so weird.
And it like it kicks into like the, you know, the Friday the 13th, yeah, the disco thing. It's fantastic. It's terrible. So weird. It's awesome.
That movie's so awesome. Bad. Because as a kid, I thought like this movie, talking about the third one, I thought as a kid that movie fit the time period, but no, Friday the 13th Part 3 came out in like 1984 or 1983 or something, when like the idea of hippies had come and gone almost entirely, like these 70s exploitation biker gangs and stuff like that. That was so 10 or 15 years behind its expiration date. So
yeah. What were you going to ask a second ago, Drew?
I was going to take you to task on. So you're saying Town That Dreaded Sundown? You're starting the slasher flicks. Why are we starting with that? Where did that come from?
Well, I really wanted to make the point that Jason stole his costume from the
character. Yeah, that
I can see that totally.
If you want to say slasher, if we're going to go with that, of course we need to go with what?
Huh? Black Christmas.
Black Christmas. Yeah.
When was Black Christmas?
74.
Okay.
Oh. Is it Black Christmas? Because it's the thing. As much as I love Halloween. Halloween takes some stuff from, takes a lot of nods, I feel, from Black Christmas. I feel like, you know, JC, you know, had seen Black Christmas, like, hey,
Jesus Christ,
the whole opening's this, you know, a POV step, you know, I don't know about steady cam, it's a POV shot to open the entire thing.
Well,
and he,
Town That Dreaded
Sundown
was made in 1952, so
felt like it.
Yeah. The thing about, well, Halloween 2, though, I mean, Carpenter more readily says that he pulled from Touch of Evil as the opening shot, which I think Bob Clark also probably pulled. I mean, that shot at the beginning of Touch of Evil is just so famous that I think that, you know, Bob Clark probably pulled from there too. Just the idea of the first-person killer perspective was relatively new at this time. So but became way overused. But it's still an iconic show. One of the things I like about the introduction to Friday the 13th is I think the movie it holds up in a weird way because it is because of the things that is not. Like the opening scene, even though it shows a death, which a lot of horror movies picked up on, like we have to start the movie with a death so everyone can, like that became the template. But it's still relatively chaste as far as horror movies go. Like you have people basically singing Kumbaya, they sing a hallelujah song. They go off to have sex, but they don't entirely disrobe. They get caught in the middle and then just they die, but not in like overly violent ways.
The idea, and I thought to myself, I was like, I've never been to in a situation where someone's played guitar and I've actually sang a song all the way through.
No, usually they just say like, I know this part of the song, and then you play and you're like, oh, I know this, and then they stop.
Yeah.
Well, you need to go to the lake. My dad will change that. He loves to sit on the porch and play songs, and you'll sing
around. A lot of Loggins and Messina?
No, not so much them. A lot of Avets and Eagles and,
Would he take it?
Hey-ho.
Would he take it kindly if... he did an Avett Brothers song, and I changed the lyrics to "Your mother is waiting. Don't tell me to. Don't let me make me tell you get in this car again."
What?
I feel like you butchered that punchline a bit.
It was. Jackson sometimes.
One of the reasons I think that the opening though is less violent than it could be is that Tom Savini was not working on the movie when they shot the opening scene. So no special effects for Savini. That is the trivia informing an opinion of mine. Like I think I because he did not work on the intro scene, I think that might be why there weren't any major effects. So it's just kind of like the one they go off to have sex, and then but it's they even talk about it in a really chaste way because she says we're special. This is special. You're special. So it's not just like hey, let's get our rocks off.
That's some rocking dialogue by Victor Miller there.
Yeah. Hey, I'm special. You're special. We're special. I don't know what the actual dialogue is, but that's the overall sentiment is they're like, hey, you're special. So let's do this. And then they start and get caught in the middle. And like in retrospect,
chlamydial?
I thought he said chlamydial.
They get chlamydial.
Message film, guys. Message.
The way that he reacts, the guy who gets killed, who was actually a production assistant on the movie, trivia. The way that he reacts is the way that every like teenager who gets caught by an adult doing something they're not supposed to do. That should have been a clue, like, but it wasn't. The way that he goes, like, "Hey, we weren't doing nothing." Like, that's the way that whenever I was caught doing something as a teenager, I wasn't supposed to be doing. That sort of like shit-eating grin that you give when you're caught doing something when you're a teenager.
Your ears turn red, and you're like, "What?
What? We're just playing."
I think that begs a question there because you're acting as if it might be a clue. Are there any clues throughout as to who this might be? Is there? I mean, does it even matter until the end who this is?
No,
it's just somebody killing people.
Yeah. Well, the couple that got killed at the end. I'm sorry, at the very beginning, the counselors that got killed. What? How long before the camp opened was that?
This was 1958.
That was the year after Jason died.
That was the year after. So the mom. Okay. Yeah. So okay.
Wasn't it 58?
I think it's the older guy. They mentioned the death of the young boy, and then a year later they mentioned the counselors who killed. And then they mentioned some fires that had been started.
That's right. Because I thought to myself, I was like, can you call one dead kid and two dead counselors a curse?
You can. Thought,
yeah, you can.
Ralph can.
Crazy Ralph.
Crazy Ralph. So I made a lot of notes for this movie. I feel like I've been waiting my whole life to talk about this movie
But I wonder too if like we were supposed to,
and now you can't because Ryan's going to talk over you.
Right. We're supposed to think that Ralph is the killer.
I don't think I ever got that.
Me either. I think we're supposed to, but
we didn't is because we knew Jason was going to be the killer.
Well,
but he's not the killer.
No, but
I think I never bought that because like even from a young age, like I knew about the. Like I think it's telegraphed that he might be the killer, but I never got that. I don't think. I mean, I think they try to make it seem like a lot of people are the killer who are not. Like, do you get the vibe that they make the camp owner kind of out to be like that's the reason why he leaves the camp mysteriously for no reason for the entirety of the movie, only to come back to get stabbed? Like, do you think that's
no? I mean.
Go ahead.
If so, that's poorly done. I got him as creepy because, like, skanking on the college age girls there. And, yeah. Like, I guess he's supposed to be older, but I'm not really sure because they all kind of look the same age.
I found it to be creepy as a kid when I watched it because I was like, that guy looks a lot older. He actually looks like the assistant coach from Evening Shade and the dude
Michael
from.
Michael Jeter?
Yeah. Like, he kind of looks
guy
like.
Of AIDS?
Did he? I thought
Mr.
that was a.
Noodle.
Yeah,
he
Mr.
his
Noodle.
Brother. Yeah, Mr. Noodle, wasn't he?
Also the guy from Green Mile.
He was on Green Mile.
And replaced by his brother, I think. What's Mr. Noodle's brother, I think?
No, Mr. Noodle.
So. Yeah. Anyway, that's who I think
trivia.
He was. Trivia. Yeah, but not about this movie.
Hey, one thing I kept thinking of in this whole movie is like, man, I wanted to get laid in the 80s so bad. It didn't work out for me. But, I mean, and it wouldn't have been gross. I mean, I was 14 in 1989, so it could have worked out nicely. But
could have. I like your optimism.
I could have. It never delivered. I was like, man, the 80s are so great for
movies.
Schooling.
I think movies completely screwed up the way that I look at everything. I thought high school would be a lot different. I thought that camp would be a lot different. I thought all of that stuff.
Sleepaway camp.
Yeah. Someone's gonna hack my head off.
Hey, since you mentioned Sleepaway Camp, did you
that
get
chick's a dude?
Did you get the when Mrs. Voorhees finally comes on the scene and she's having the conversations with
Jason?
Not Jason. Well, not Jason, but with the other
Alice.
Alice, yeah. It's almost like the mom from Sleepaway Camp kind of felt like she was channeling that woman in that because she would turn and talk to herself. She's like, no, I wouldn't do that. Not to the extent that the crazy mom in Sleepaway Camp did it, but I kind of got that vibe while watching it now this time. I wonder if Sleepaway Camp kind of took a part of that because of the way the woman...
Perchance. I mean, Voorhees.
Yes.
I would say definitely.
I'm going to go ahead and say any movie you want to mention later 80s, any slasher movie that has anything remotely similar to Friday the 13th, yes, they took it from Friday the 13th.
Especially at a camp. I think that... That definitely has something to do with it. It takes something of a camp. It definitely takes from Friday the 13th.
I mean, I think it is. I think when it comes down to it, I mean, I think as much as I love Halloween, it's a far superior film to Friday the 13th. I mean, Friday the 13th, I think, ends up being the more possibly important genre film for what comes after it, in the sense that no one else is trying to make a good movie a la Halloween.
Right.
They were trying to make, you know, something like Friday the 13th that's just going to make money. It didn't matter what else was going on as long as it was competent enough.
It's like the Ramones and the Sex Pistols. Like, the Ramones were a far better and more important punk band, but the Sex Pistols more popularized punk, even though they were inferior. I agree. And I also think, though, I watched Friday the 13th more than I did Halloween growing up. Like,
I
as
did
a kid.
Too.
Like,
raw numbers, partly I think because it came on television so much.
I was going to say too, that it would come on TBS or whatever on Saturday afternoons and I would just watch it because it was on.
Or like USA Up All Night would show like Friday the 13th 1 and then Friday the 13th part 6. I think most of my cultural sort of understanding of Friday the 13th comes from these weird TV edits of the movies. And like the first one really doesn't need that much of an edit, though. It's a fairly like innocuous horror movie as far as these go. Like, as extreme as the later ones get, like this one's relatively like unsexy, and like it is violent. Like the Kevin, I don't know that they cut the Kevin Bacon scene even that much for the TV version. Maybe they did, but I distinctly remember that scene. So I don't remember if that's me renting it a lot or what, but I guess it is kind of violent, but like some of the deaths take place off screen too.
Many of them do, of them do, honestly. I mean, or most, it also, I had never noticed as much until I was watching it today. How that scene, you looked like you had frozen there, Brian.
It's like I couldn't tell if you were stopping to like deliver a slowly like you were.
This is
like,
my reasoned argument
for effect. Like, this is what is right. Like, I thought you were doing that. And I was like, oh, oh,
That sounds awesome.
I might just cut it down and leave it in. No, I'll cut it out, but
You broke down it. How quick they.
Yeah, the quick cutaways. Can you just repeat that part? Because that's really all that we lost was you talked about quick cuts.
I had not noticed until watching it today, really, how quickly they cut away from several of the death scenes, from the beginning of the movie, with Chrissy in the woods when she gets her throat slashed, is a pretty quick flash to, I think, a white screen at that point, which they like that flash to white a lot, or in the movie quite a bit. And they did it again with the axe kill of Kevin Bacon's girlfriend, and they cut away from her very quickly to the light, which you think that'd be a great shot if somehow like the blood, it's splattered up onto the light, and so you get like this weird red blood lit effect. But no, we're just looking at a light.
And I think that also speaks to how early in the slasher genre, it's kind of like these conventions that we sort of understand now are things they were still trying to figure out at that point. So I think that's also kind of where it comes from too. Like at that point, I'm sure they're like, oh my God, they show the arrow going through his neck. Ah. And that scene weirdly goes on for far longer. The deaths of women tend to have sort of like a brevity that, or off screen, the girl at the archery range, she dies off camera entirely, right? I can't remember now.
Paula Poundstone?
Is that what you think that looks like?
Yeah. Something like that. She to me, she had the complete character of a female comic from that, you know, that would come out in later time period there. Just the way she acted and several things about her. And that awful, awful nightgown.
Yeah, that nightgown was literally the worst thing about the
Hey, well, how about, I also found that, like, the most non-sexual game of strip poker ever.
Strip Monopoly. That's why.
Strip Monopoly. Yeah, it was like, this is not going to be sexy at all.
Well, it was Alice, Paula Poundstone, and Bob.
Also, I mean, things get pretty heated in Monopoly.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to have to yell with my dong out.
It just makes it that much more ridiculous.
Right.
Get it?
Well, everything was fine until Brian put his dick on Boardwalk.
That's another thing that I think is, it shows how they were trying to stretch the movie, because once, I don't think that Victor Miller quite knew what to do with the kids once it started raining and they were, you know, sort of like quarantined within the cabins. Like, what am I going to do with these kids to have them pass the time while they get picked off one by one? And so I guess that's what the kids are doing. Strip Monopoly. Yeah, right. Like, I also thought that there would be many more like strip games as a teenager. Like, this is how we're going to pass the time as a teenager, is through these kinds of strip games. But no, that's not even within spitting distance of what happened in actual reality.
Yeah, funny. Real teenagers don't like to take off their clothes as much as what you find when you were actually a teenager as well. You're like, this is not, no, no thanks.
Completely driven by hormones.
I don't want to take my shirt off in front of everybody. No way.
Yeah. We may have just hung around the wrong people.
Also,
we survived, so maybe it was the right people.
Yes,
that's true.
Yes, that's true.
I never ended up getting hacked to death at camp, although I did have bug spray sprayed in my hair.
You had what?
Bug spray. Like, the last night I was at my first sleepaway camp, the last night they TP'd and, they put shaving cream everywhere, and everyone in our bunk, like, it was two people from our bunk, everyone in the bunk, they sprayed bug spray in their hair. Like, as they slept, and I was one of the victims.
That's
what
dangerous.
Did that do? Did it do anything?
Did it do anything?
I mean, it's just.
It just smelled bad.
Okay, like, that's what I was figuring. Yeah, it's like. Yeah.
It smelled really bad.
Bug spray, too. That probably had, like, you know, napalm in it.
Probably.
DDT. It was DDT, at least.
Yeah, that's, it was just straight DDT.
That's why I have my bald spot, is because of an errant accident at sleepaway camp in fifth grade. Also, they were eighth graders, so I obviously wasn't going to say anything because I was a fifth grader.
Hey, you know what? I don't think I ever realized until watching this movie today. I don't know that I actually ever realized or paid enough attention to that cop talking to realize it was actually occurring on Friday the 13th. I just kind of always assumed that was just kind of generic, it's an unlucky day, kind of awful time to have things happen, so it makes for a good title.
Oh, yeah, I noticed that, too. Isn't it also Jason's birthday, or his anniversary? It's the anniversary.
It's his birthday. Today is his birthday.
That's right. It is. You're right.
I never put that together.
Just the 13th, not Friday, though.
maybe, yeah, I think you're right. And I think maybe it's just that happened to be that time was right. A Friday.
Yeah, it just happened to be on that day. Yeah.
Right.
I never noticed. I think I just always in my head just had it was like, oh, it's just the connotation of that day. It makes for an awful day for this to happen and a catchy title for a series.
Yeah.
Because they say it really quickly. He's like, oh, it's Friday the 13th. And then he focuses more on the full moon. The cop does. Oh, there's a full moon. Everybody goes crazy on a full moon.
Yeah, like vaguely. This movie is just full of vague cliches about scary things.
Well, you know, I used to not believe in the full moon thing until, I mean, the last decade of my life, I've found that it is actually true. That when it's a full moon, people actually do go ape shit.
Really?
Yeah.
I still have not. I know people sit there and say it all the time, especially with the job I have. Mm-hmm. People talk about it all the time. Yeah. And I have not experienced where I thought it's been made a difference, honestly.
I just find that it seems to be when, like, we'd always get the worst calls or the something bad, like, just the shit that you just would never want to happen would happen on those days. And you're like, oh, my God.
Or is it like...
Or just maybe I just notice it more because
yeah.
It is...
I think it's that there's a specific bias that's called that where you
confirmation bias.
Yeah, confirmation bias. Exactly. Where you take in all the information you want and discard all the stuff that you don't like. That's why people are superstitious is that when something that's how superstitions start is like when something like a broken mirror happens, they discard all of the good luck and then only pay attention to the bad luck. And then they're like, well, it's because of that mirror. Same thing for with Friday the 13th, I guess. Like, I'm sure that started at some point, and then because something bad happened on a date like that, and then it just carried forward.
Yeah, it was killed at that camp.
Yeah, exactly. So the death curse line happens fairly quickly in the movie. I didn't realize, I thought it happened way later. I thought it happened when he first appeared, like, out of the pantry or whatever, but it happens at 8:52. There's a death curse.
And when she sees him outside of the store, and they, right before she's so insulting to Enos, I believe his name is.
She's kind of.
Calls him an American original. You're an American original. What the hell does that mean?
I also didn't realize the sort of politics that are at play here because I never noticed the way that it seems like it plays on two levels because it may have just been that. They were superstitious of her because she was going to the camp. But it also seemed to be that, like, she's a young hiker, hippie, that from that generation, and they're all, like, these old small-town people. And I never picked up on that sort of dynamic, really, until today. Or until yesterday when I watched the movie. Did you guys notice that at all? Like, when she walks, the one who's hiking at the very beginning, when she walks into the diner, they all just sort of, like, turn and stare.
All the forks drop. The ching.
I mean, I don't feel that seeing it today, I thought of it any differently than I had in the past. I feel like I have felt that before, not trying to be dickish about it or anything like that. I mean, I feel like what you're saying there, like, I feel like, yeah, I've realized that, you know, weird relationship kind of deal there. Because I never really tell how kind of obnoxious she was, though, until today.
She
I was kinda
is
like,
talking to dogs and also... saying that working, like the her spiel about working with kids. Also, that scene is weird where they're driving because there's so much use of the first person. Like, I am certain that that is meant to be a misdirection to make us think that that dude could potentially be the killer, but they also use it from her perspective as well. Like, it just seems like a really bad use of the first person, right? Or did you guys notice that?
They're trying to confuse you so you don't know who the killer is.
I guess.
Well, I think that is one thing. I think early on, because of its weird kind of Agatha Christie-esque, and then there were none kind of origins. I think early on they're really trying to give you these red herrings, like you said, like with Ralph and with just about anyone being the killer. But before they realize later on, it doesn't matter at all. Mm-hmm. This isn't a mystery, and I think that's the thing that Friday the 13th is trying to figure out more than its later slasher. Descendants is it's not really the mystery of who the killer is that really matters. It's what the killer does that actually ends up being the more important thing. And at the end, it's, oh, okay, it was that guy. Okay, gotcha.
That's a really interesting way of thinking about it. I don't know that I've ever thought about it in those terms, but I like that thesis because it really doesn't matter because we don't see Mrs. Voorhees throughout the entirety of the movie. So it doesn't really matter who the killer is, because it ultimately is not. It's ultimately a really bad plot device, honestly.
When she shows up.
The fact that she is the killer and they introduce her with like 20 minutes left in the movie, that's awful.
I have it.
We should have seen her in the town at some point. There should have been someone she ran into. It should have been someone that got mentioned somewhere. Yeah,
like the camp owner talks to her or something, because it's a really bad use of that plot device. If I were an adult watching that movie now, I would feel entirely 100% ripped off by that ending.
I have it written down as a deus ex machina.
That can be the subtitle for the episode, deus ex machina.
Well, the other thing I had a problem with, and maybe it's because it's not supposed to make any sense because she's just a grieving mother, is that she's been
grieving for a while. That kid died in 57.
Not
she lost
that,
her mind.
But she wasn't there. How did she know what happened?
She was a cook.
She was a cook at the camp.
Oh, she was?
Yeah.
Well, goddamn. There goes that just destroyed a whole thing that I had. Okay.
Yeah, she was a cook at the camp. That's why.
Well, why wasn't she watching her kid? I mean,
she was working. That was the counselor's job.
Yeah, the counselor was supposed to be watching it. Was it a camp for special children? Did she say that?
All children are special, Tyler.
I don't think it was from seeing everyone else. But here's the thing. We don't see it when Jason was there. We don't know if later on. And even in that scene at the beginning when we see with the couple, we don't really see the campers much. We see the counselors there, don't we?
It's true.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if it was a special needs camp or not. But it is interesting, though, that it makes me wonder, did she kill that first girl, Chrissy, at the beginning because she was mad because she was going to cook at the camp? Because she was I did not thought about that until you said that about her being the cook and reminded me of that. And that's what Chrissy was supposed to be showing up to do.
Oh, interesting.
That's...
She kills a lot of other people, so it's not like she only...
But she kills the cook first.
Yeah, so it's just interesting.
That's an interesting connection I've never made.
I'd never thought about it until just then.
Yeah. Well,
it didn't even dawn on me that she was the cook, so...
Yeah, the mom.
Yeah.
And here's the thing, Betsy Palmer, that's probably the best performance in the entire movie as well. Like, when she comes, like, she pulls off the crazy, the crazy lady thing really well. That in a movie like that, it might not be done as well with someone else kind of deal. That's off. Yeah,
she would never have taken the role of Mrs. Voorhees, but she needed a new car. she actually called the script a pile of shit after reading it. She worked for 10 days and made $1,000 a day, so she made $10,000 to play the role of Mrs. Voorhees, and she hated the movie.
I wonder if she tried to milk a couple more days out of it so she'd get like the extra options.
So she's like, she's this movie's Donald Pleasance.
Yeah, I actually made a note of that, though, because like Donald Pleasance, he was bewildered by the experience of working on the film Halloween. he didn't understand what the movie was supposed to be about. But he ended up liking it at the end. How do you think you would feel differently about A, Donald Pleasance, or B, the movie, if he had called it a pile of shit after doing the first one? I mean, that presupposes
a
lot.
This is a man who is in a movie called Puma Man, so I'm pretty sure his standards were at a different level than he'd like to believe they were. But I think that also is the difference, though, between Halloween and Friday the 13th, though, is like looking at it, even if he's bewildered and doesn't get it, I think even still then it's like, there's something else going on here. Like, this is something good being done. Whereas in Friday, sure, it's entertaining, but you're not getting... you don't sit there and watch it and be like, wow, you're not seeing like a guy like Dean Cundey isn't, behind the scenes setting up this awesome shot. You're, working with some pretty standard, cinematography. There's one great shot in Friday the 13th. That's on the lake when she's in the canoe on the lake. Beautiful shot. And that's about it.
Which they didn't originally want to shoot. I think Tom Savini came up with the idea for that shot and they shot it.
That's a great shot.
They shot it in 3 consecutive months to get it right. I think they shot it in September, October, and November. And the last time they shot it, I think, was the take that they kept. And it was 28 degrees outside when they did that shot, and she got pulled into the ocean.
It's beautiful. It is literally the most beautiful shot that you could have in those.
Yeah.
In that movie.
And the score, that like shimmery. I mean, the score almost sounds like light hitting a rippling lake.
Yeah. So, no, it's, I mean, that right there is encapsulates the highest moment, I think, of that movie as far as artistic, you know, endeavor goes. But that ends up being the thing with, you know, going back to the Donald Pleasance and Halloween thing, is there's a lot more of that happening on a regular basis, I think, in, you know, Halloween. So it's he was like, I don't understand what we're doing.
I still think that you should dress as him for Halloween and then just show up, pop up in random places confused.
Hey, Lonnie, get your ass away from there.
You'd like that bit, wouldn't you? You go to hell.
The evil is gone. He's gone from here.
And then Tyler,
you don't know what death is.
You can go with Malcolm McDowell. The Malcolm McDowell Loomis.
Yeah. Ooh.
The three stages of Loomis. We could do like Halloween 1 Loomis, Halloween 4 Loomis,
Dead Loomis in 6, where you just get him screaming in the background because Donald Pleasance was dead. And they were just shooting scenes of him like, ah! Ah! Oh, yeah.
Man, so, man. All right. The movie is fairly like unplot-y. Like, they all show up at the camp, and then it seems like they spend a lot of time. It seems like a lot of what happens in the movie was figured out as they were on set. Like the weird Native American like dancing around scene, like that doesn't seem like that was scripted, does it? Or does it? Like when the cop shows up and he's dancing around for no reason, except he's sort of goofy.
I don't know. I mean, you got your teen, you know, you got some young teen actors and young actors, at least. You're putting them in some sort of costume and acting them, asking them to act kind of like, why does Kevin Bacon try to pick up the cop's, you know, his CB when he's when they're calling him on his on his motorcycle? It's like, really?
Yeah, true. I guess it's just, I don't know. Like, I don't know. That's a good point. But it seems like once the movie should be getting going, and it seems like they are constantly trying to find things to do. I do kind of like the plot device, but I kind of like the idea of them like trying to get this camp together. But it seems like they're very, very ho-hum about like, I guess we'll do some stuff now, because they almost immediately give up on it. Like as soon as the camp owner, the camp owner leaves, they're just like, all right, now let's go get high and play Strip Monopoly.
Right. And that's why we lose the camp owner. We take away their adult, you know, supervision, mm-hmm. essentially. And then that's what teenagers will do.
Right. I guess I never put that together, that's the reason why they just sort of like give up on the raison d'etre. Like the reason
you'd never put it together is because the owner of the camp looks the same age as everybody else. Yeah, don't really think of him as the adult.
He's 30 at the most.
He still looks older than I do.
Looks 45. Yeah, like everyone in this movie looks 40.
But in that time period, that is the funny thing. Yeah, it's
like the standards for what young looks like have changed so much in the last 30 years. I guess 34.
Maybe I always love old yearbooks and looking at seniors from 1984. It's like, holy shit, that guy looks 50.
Well, the difference is that we have a cult of youth now that was not present. Like people, we always try to look older than we were, whereas people now still try. Like it seems as though they attempt to like maintain a sense of youth about them that is not like is omnipresent even after they get out of high school.
He was 35. The guy who played Steve Christie was 35.
Okay. And so everyone else was 32. So,
yeah, there was no way Alice. Well, Alice wasn't.
Alice is 21.
Oh wow.
Or 20, actually, maybe right at 20.
That in the haircut. Movie, supposed to be 20.
No, I'm talking the actress.
God Almighty.
The hairdos in this movie do none of the people justice. Like that bob hairdo, whatever thing that Alice has, like that has never. On, like it doesn't work, does it? As a hairdo,
I don't know. I find there's something intriguing about Alice. I mean, that's a very early '80s, you know, late '70s, I guess, even more. I mean, yes, it's 1980, but that's still, you know, late '70s more than anything. I mean, that's very much a look from that time period. But it's a much more motherly kind of hair. Yeah. It's not a young girl's hair.
Is the sort of frumpy, like not. She's not engaging in all of this craziness that everyone is. She's interested in an older man. So she does definitely has that. The movie attempts to establish her as like more mature than her surroundings. And so that it cultivates that idea that was not explicit in Halloween, but was implicit, which is like the more chaste of the people is the one who will survive. So we get to that trope in this movie, but it makes it more explicit, it seems.
Right. Yeah.
So as far as the deaths go, I mean, I don't think that we need to go like plot point by plot point through the deaths of all the counselors. Is there a favorite that you guys like?
I mean, I think still Kevin Bacon's arrow through the throat is probably the standout.
That's the good one. And even the throat slash was kind of it. If you weren't expecting that and hadn't seen anything like that before, it was kind of disturbing.
Yeah, Tom Savini, man, was on top of his game. But this movie doesn't have as much gore as I expected. I think the arrow through the throat is a standout because it's the most explicitly gory. But that might be because the budget was rather small. It was only $550,000, which at this point in time was really super low. But he did so much work on this movie. Even like he not only did he do all of the effects, but he was helping like come up with scenes, and he also played stunt double a few times. Like the scene later when we have our, you know, when we have the lead discovering all the dead bodies, when Brenda gets thrown through the window, the body that goes through the window, that's actually Tom Savini wearing a wig jumping through a window.
Like, I wonder if he got pressured on set too. Like, man, I wish we'd had a stuntman that could do this.
I just feel like Savini has so many fun stories like that, like with the original Maniac, where, you know, I think we mentioned this during the remake, where it's his head. He has to play that character because that gets the shotgun to the head because they didn't have enough time to make up another model head. He had one of himself, so he's that guy who gets, you know, shot with a shotgun. Imagine he has several stories like that where, like, oh, I'm the only guy. So, all right, let's do it.
He lived, I mean, he's sort of like the Chris Christopherson of horror movies because he was a photographer in Vietnam, and like that's where he got a lot of his later inspirations for what he put into film. And so like he just seems like a madman who's willing to do anything, like early on especially, just like a punk rock kind of like whatever, man, DIY, let's do this sort of, like, he seems like the kind of guy would be like, yeah, fuck it, I'll jump through a window, who gives a shit. Like, I love that about that dude.
Does he have a memoir at this point? Because, man, I was just thinking that would be a really great one to read.
It would totally be a great memoir to read. I don't know, but if not, like, let's pitch that to that guy. Like, please,
seriously,
please write your memoirs.
Yeah.
It seems like the kind of guy that would get a wicked drunk on and start a bunch of fights.
Yeah, I'm sure he did. Like, one only need to watch, not Once Upon a Time in Mexico. What was the Tarantino flick?
Dusk Till Dawn.
From Dusk Till Dawn. Yeah. Like, that looks like the kind of angry fun he would have. What was his name in that movie? Love Gun something? I don't know. It was something because he had remember the penis gun?
Yes.
What was his name? I don't remember.
I don't remember.
But yeah, Tom Savini is definitely the rocks, like, the lost diamond of this movie, because even though a lot of people, like critics, panned it or whatever, Tom Savini had a major hand in making this movie work in the way that it did, I think.
Yeah, and he works with some, I mean, he works with some even lower tier ones after this.
I mean, he did Maniac. The
Prowler. And, yeah. Well, Maniac has a weird issue. I would say Maniac in some ways is better than this, though, again, less iconic. But, you know, we're talking the same year even. Yeah, both 1980.
Were they? Yeah. I don't know why I thought that Maniac came out a little bit later, like 82, 83.
Yeah, no. And then when you had The Prowler, which is another big one, he did, I won't say big one, but another one of the memorable horror movies he did after, very soon after Friday. So,
interesting. Have you guys ever been really impressed with the protagonist finding all the dead bodies at one time scene? Like, is that something that should have been taken from Halloween and then made into a thing?
The kind of the haunted house scene? I mean, probably not. I mean, it was probably not my favorite scene in Halloween, even.
Yeah.
I mean, it was not my favorite scene in Halloween, even. But it was taken and then obviously was used in Friday again.
But it also makes it always makes it feel like there was a grand design for this one moment that they'd find all these bodies, and that would be the, like, oh, this is it for you.
Yeah, and that
I did chase you through the whole movie, but I also had the time to design this horror ride,
which is what
this
fits.
Elaborate like something that the Joker would have come up with in
exactly.
The Killing Joke.
But I get Michael having done that. Like there was a purpose behind what he was trying to do. He was trying to kind of stage something and set a tableau, even I guess for. His sister, as he knew, and everyone else did not. But not so much in this one. Also, not to mention the fact that, I mean, my mom couldn't set up this whole deal that Mrs. Voorhees sets up. And that's pretty much who Mrs. Voorhees is your mom doing all this.
Hey, don't you talk about my mom. I'm just kidding. Yeah. Dorothy
Mantooth's a saint.
I think, Drew, a comment that you made really could be said about every movie that is not Halloween. Like every slasher movie that comes after Halloween that is not Halloween, which is in Halloween, a lot of it was done specifically with a purpose in mind. Whereas like the things that are done in Friday the 13th are done because Halloween does it and not with a specific purpose in mind. Like it's a very, as far as movies go, it's a very thoughtless movie. I think it still looks good as far as cinematography. Later, it gets really unnecessarily dark, but as far as...
Dork.
But as far as the movie, the look of the movie, I think the movie looks pretty cool. It looks like someone almost made that movie later to make it look like a movie from 1980. But it's a very thoughtless movie in that it's like, well, they did it. Like, it doesn't have a philosophy of thought behind why it does what it does.
Hey, just so you know, Tom Savini's name in Dust Till Dawn is Sex Machine.
Sex Machine. Yeah. I knew it wasn't Love Gun.
You know who his buddy next to him's name is? Uh-huh. Who plays the buddy next to him?
Uh-huh.
Greg Nicotero.
Oh, is it Nicotero?
Well, that's right.
I haven't seen it in a long time. I haven't seen the movie in a while. It's good. I like it.
What's the series is on like a... They're on like their third or fourth
season. No. Like it just started. The series? The TV show?
No.
Oh, no. Are you talking about the movie series or the TV series, Brian?
TV series.
Oh.
Yeah, no. It just started.
I thought there were a couple of seasons in.
I don't think so. Mm. It's on that El Rey network, which I think...
Right, you're right. That's right. And that only... that's right. Okay. That makes sense, yes.
Which we don't have access to, do we?
No, I've never...
I have it.
...seen access to it. Really?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Is it in Spanish or English?
I don't know. I've never turned it to it.
Watch it, Brian. Blog about it.
I don't know if I have it or not.
Appealed to me about that network, the only thing I know is on that network is the For Dust Till Dawn show.
Yeah.
Seems awesome. Yeah.
Anything else?
It could be one of the, you know, like every once in a while, I have DirecTV, so every once in a while they will add hundreds of channels that I don't know about.
Right.
Because I don't check the little email that I get. I do. Actually, I do have El Rey.
Whoa.
How about that? Oh, there you go. Check this out. Tomorrow, 12 a.m., the director's chair, John Carpenter.
Cool.
Oh, nice. On El Rey?
Yeah.
What other channel does that show come on?
But it's also John Carpenter there, and then John Carpenter, and then Guillermo del Toro right after that. So
cool.
I'm just curious because I'm not sure. I assumed it was an English language channel, but I don't know if it's English or Spanish language.
I'll record it and then see what it's in. So
yeah, that sounds awesome.
They also show X-Files and Starsky and Hutch reruns
in Espanol. That would be awesome.
Oh, and Candyman comes on tomorrow, too. How about that?
Otherwise, I'm less interested in all this if it's actually in English. I'm much more interested
in Spanish. I only want to watch this in Spanish now.
I just want to see the X-Files in Espanol.
You didn't watch it when you were younger with the secondary audio package on your TV?
No, with the sap on?
Yeah. Get your sap on.
One of the things I was least impressed with was I was thinking as far as the kills go, I was thinking about the iconic nature of them, and very few of these beyond the Kevin Bacon one, almost none of the kills except for the death of Mrs. Voorhees are iconic. Right. Because all of the Friday the 13th, one of the things I remember about them is that they always have the thing at the beginning that tells you, like, last time on Friday the 13th. Very few of these end up in those later ones. Like, the one you always see is the guy in the wheelchair with the machete in his face.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I still can't remember if that's from 2 or 3 or what.
Well, you just said it last week. You had it right last week, and you had said it was...
2?
Yeah.
I think so.
Whatever you because said it was continue, last week was right.
Because they continue the trope of, like, the thoughtless, like, oh, teenagers are going to, like, play board games or handheld video games or have arm wrestling competitions. Like, that, it's just so silly. Like, they're here, so let's have them have this weird plot thing that does not move the movie forward at all. And I think he was initiating arm wrestling competitions. Anyway.
I think it's interesting, but it's like almost like the Bond franchise there. Like, in this movie, just the the things that you come to know in the Bond movies don't exist yet.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, in Dr. No, it doesn't
hang on
begin
one second.
And just.
All right, man, that sounds good. Cool.
So, Drew, you were saying that it's like the Bond series in that most of the things that we come to know from the Bond series have not shown up yet.
Right, and like the first in Dr. No, you don't have the things that set up, that you start to know as a Bond movie, and you don't have the things you know as a Friday the 13th movie yet. You don't have the kills, you don't have Jason even, but that comes later because, I mean, just not established as part of the franchise yet.
And they didn't intend for this to be a franchise movie. They actually, obviously they didn't think of the final scene of, Alice being dragged into the water until they were shooting the movie. And so they didn't even start to think about there being a sequel to this movie until afterwards. Like, they didn't, even though it was a cash grab, like, it was not one that was intended to be one with a franchise potential, which is, in watching Never Sleep Again, the documentary about Nightmare on Elm Street, until Bob Shea got his hands on it at New Line, A Nightmare on Elm Street was the same way. Like, Wes Craven never intended for that to become a franchise, nor did anyone involved in the movie until Bob Shea, until the movie did well. Like, they were just hoping that it wouldn't tank because that would probably have taken the studio with it. So I'm sure this is a very similar
situation. It's what saved the studio, so.
Yeah, the house that Freddie built. So it wasn't until Bob Shea, the day after the, I'm sure that the Saturday after that movie did well, he's like, all right, now, how are we going to... So I'm sure this was the same thing with Sean Cunningham or, whoever ended up taking up. Do we know, did Sean Cunningham have a continuing role with the franchise?
He stuck around as producer, I'm
pretty
sure.
Yeah, he did.
So I'm sure that like the Saturday.
He produced the newer one, the remake.
He produced.
Yeah, I mean, he's still around as that guy.
But as far as, I'm sure that the night, like when the movie came out, that it was just like, oh man, yeah, this has got it. This is going to become a thing. Because I actually read a review on Amazon, and it was from someone who said he worked at a movie theater in 1980 and said that they were not prepared for this movie because it opened on the smallest screen, and so there was a line completely around the block to see Friday the 13th. So.
And that's exactly what this kind of movie needed. I mean, that's the whole thing. Like, but still, I'd argue what one of the biggest problems that a Your Next has right now is, I mean, you and I, we went and saw it together. Where the show showed on that gigantic screen with this Titanic theater, and that's not where you want to see that movie. Mm-mm. You want to see it in the most cramped.
The AC's not working.
Theater in the auditorium in the theater where everyone's packed together. Feeding off everyone's energy, not where you're,
like how we saw
out.
The strangers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Well, and were we literally the only people in there, or were there two other people in Your Next when we saw?
There were like two or three other people, but not a lot. Yeah, it was pretty much, and it was such a big theater, we were on opposite ends of it.
Yeah, we could afford to like stretch out. But yeah, I mean, this just came from a very particular time in cinematic history where it was, there, even though there were indie movies, there were still distribution deals happening. Like, there's just so much media today. Like, that's one of the running themes in the other podcasts is like, that's why nothing ever gets the recognition it deserves now, is that there's just so much information and media to be consumed. Like, there is no like one horror thing to satisfy you now. Like, there is no like, oh, this is the horror movie that is opening. But I guess that did just happen this weekend with Annabelle, like, because it's October and it's a horror movie, people are going to flock to it.
Yeah, it's the only one in theaters. It wasn't awful.
I want to see it. I just haven't had a chance. I might go see it tomorrow.
I mean, I've seen much worse. I've seen better too. So
I've heard it's very bland.
Yeah, I mean,
it looks bland from the previews. Yeah.
But I mean, I've definitely seen things. I'm like, oh, that was much worse than this. So it has that going for it.
And so. Like, as far as Friday the 13th goes, like, it was just an accidental miracle. Just like Nightmare on Elm Street, like, they expected to maybe make their money back, but then it made, $6 million or something, and like that's a crazy amount of money for a movie that was that small. Then their expectations.
Well, Halloween even. I mean, it was the biggest independent film until the Blair Witch Project.
John Carpenter is still spending Halloween money.
I mean, it's just crazy. But I mean, all these were people just didn't realize what they were, what kind of gold mine they were sitting on with teenagers wanting to go to movies in the 1980s until that point. And it's like, shit, they just want to see them. They just want to see each other naked and killed.
Yeah. You know who did see the gold mine? Steve Miner.
Oh, yeah. That was a good one.
Oh, that's that sound effect you just made, Tyler, sound like you're about to start breaking into Mr.'s Broken Wings.
I do wonder, it is intriguing to think, Sean Cunningham had worked with Wes Craven earlier in Last House on the Left. Mm-hmm. What if he had convinced Wes Craven to direct this?
That would have been crazy. I mean, Wes Craven came out of Nightmare on Elm Street with a very negative view of movies because of his experience with Bob Shea. Like, he definitely did not want to return to Nightmare on Elm Street or anything New Line. He wanted to have nothing to do with New Line because Bob Shea was such a dick. So that would have been interesting, like, if he could have. But he was also very pretentious, Wes Craven was.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because
Last House on the Left is a much... I mean, Last House on the Left is based on Bergman.
Yeah. As to hear him talk about... And not... I guess I'm jumping ahead to the future, perhaps. But to hear him talk about the way that original movie was constructed, like, it has all of these elements that I don't see, like... I see that they're there, but I don't see the philosophy that went into making that movie.
What are we talking about?
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Okay. Well, let's delve into that this week.
Yeah, let's not delve in, Brian. So
we can delve into that next week.
Well, let's talk about like the last third. I know that this is a long podcast, but we got to talk about it. The end of the movie. Let's talk about all this crazy shit happens, and bodies are getting hacked up, and
Miss Voorhees literally loses her head over her son dying.
Literally.
That's good. No, let's talk about from the time.
It's hard to fight in the video game, too, when you had to fight her head.
Yeah.
You know that figure is at Toys R Us right now, that the Jason Friday the 13th video game figure, the purple suit.
Really? Cool.
It's $30, though.
How much?
30?
No,
is
thanks.
Is it Toys R Us exclusive?
It is a Toys R Us exclusive.
Okay. Well, anyway, so like, let's talk about
this. Tyler runs out of Toys R Us right now.
I know. Okay. You guys finish the podcast. I'm going. No, the thing we should talk about is her appearance and like her performance and sort of like how this is. It is not what people expect in a horror movie. Like, this is a level of sort of like weird psychological guilt that we don't expect of horror movies. Like, what contemporary movies have this sort of element to them at the end, where we have a character not just showing up to kill, but we have a character who like explains her entire, like the entire reason behind the murders, like monologuing. Like, is this something that we see in a lot of movies from this time period? I didn't think of this question before. Like, is there another movie that has this kind of ending? Like, as shallow as we've talked about this movie being, like, this is such a weird and strange ending. Like, I think that's why it works.
Because you're talking about, like, her reasoning for everything and all?
Well, just
that her actually showing up and being like, oh, yeah, I'm doing this because of this, this, and this.
Or do you think they need it because she hasn't been in the entire movie? Like, it needs this sort of build up, like, of her explaining herself.
Well, I mean, I think it, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think it's still, when that happens and she comes out and does all this, I think it ends up showing, I mean, it's a pretty great idea for a revenge movie when you come down to it. And that's really all it comes down to. I mean, hell, you turn the movie the fuck around and it's Death Wish and we're pulling for her.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, we're just seeing it from the other side and we're just seeing she's a crazed maniac killing all these people. But, you know, we watch it from Charlie Bronson's side and it's like he's avenging his family.
Charlie Bronson. Yeah. No, I think that's an interesting way of thinking about it. Yeah. They unintentionally did something really interesting at the end of this movie, I think, because they back themselves into a narrative corner by not giving us enough information to figure out who the killer would be, because they don't ever show the killer
right
at all. Like, even as, you know, the innocuous whatever. So having her show up and then explain, like, have this like tour de force performance at the end of the movie, like, that's so interesting. And it is unintentional, because they're just like, oh shit, we have to let everybody know why she is a killer. But it's so interesting because it's so different from horror movies that we had seen before. Like, usually the killer shows up and just Like, we see the killer and the killer kills, and then, like, we have had this buildup over the course of the movie because it's like, oh, did you hear about the, like, whatever. Like, this movie's so different from that. It has such an interesting twist. I don't know. Like, I find that to be really, like, a compelling argument for the, like, the quality of this movie to a certain degree. I don't know. Maybe not.
Maybe not.
I mean, I think, like you said, I think it's an interesting, I mean, it becomes an interesting revenge movie at that point, but I think it's a poor version of what it's supposed to have been throughout, which is a kind of a mystery, because there is no real mystery.
It's always a mystery.
So it makes it interesting, at least in that sense, that it's like, by fucking something else up, they got something else right, I guess.
Exactly. Like, that's kind of how I think of it, is like,
the thing they wanted to get right, they got wrong, and they inadvertently were like, oh, well, this worked.
By not sprinkling the right kinds of clues throughout the movie to have you be able to understand, like, sort of, like, that third act could have been way shorter if they had done their job in the first two acts, but like, the end of that movie is way too long. I got bored, honestly, by the end of that movie, because from the time she shows up to the time she dies is like 20 minutes of screen time, which is way too much.
And she comes in, her performance is good, and she's initially a very intriguing antagonist, but then all of a sudden you realize she's a really weak villain.
Right.
Because, I mean, honestly, if she's not fighting Alice, this movie is probably already over. If one of those guys had survived.
Yeah.
Exactly.
This movie's pretty much done.
Totally.
Because, I mean, once her surprise is over, I mean, she gets everyone else because they don't know she's bad, and she kills them before they figure it out. But once people figure it out, I mean, she gets beheaded by Alice. I mean, what would have happened if even the, you know, Tonto friend had survived or whatever?
Right, like, but...
Sit on it, Tonto.
What's, I mean, other than the obvious fourth wall breaking... Hey, the audience needs to know what this is. Like, what compels her to tell Alice, as opposed to just stab her the way that she stabbed everybody else? Like, is it just
crazy?
Do you think it's just? Go ahead. Sorry.
If she didn't monologue to every one of these other people too, and we're just catching the very end where she actually kills them. Yeah. She could have told them all of this, the same story.
She has a reason for what she's doing. She doesn't want. She wants Jason to be avenged, and if they don't know why she's doing what she's doing, it defeats the purpose. If they just die, it doesn't quite accomplish her goal, I guess.
But she doesn't tell everybody, just
well, like Brian said, we don't know, I guess. Yeah. But you're right, she doesn't.
I mean,
I agree.
I think the idea that maybe she is choosing to monologue to all these people, and they're really just asking her to kill them at the end. They're like, Jesus Christ, you just kill me?
Just kill me.
I mean, and then the weird sort of more meta argument is, they don't need to know, but we need to know.
Yeah.
So she had to explain it to us, I guess.
Yeah, and like, that's an awkward way. I mean, that's always the problem with movies, especially with villains. You know, you get this, like, especially, I mean, think about Bond movies, like the monologue of like, well, this is why I want to take over the world. Like, we get that. So it's like, it's not completely foreign to us as filmgoers, but it's still a weird device at the end here. And like, to make an argument, it could be because Alice is the most mature of them. Maybe she has been watching Alice, and Alice, I mean, she's obviously been watching all of them, and maybe Alice is the one she's like, I want her to understand before I kill her. Like, this is a symbolic death.
I almost questioned her killing everyone.
Yeah.
Like, it seems purposeless at that point, because you're not killing anyone who's truly had anything to do with your son's death. And at what Steve Christie's done, those teenagers don't really, they're not going to put that camp back together themselves.
No. Well, so, I mean, presumably she would survive, and, well, I guess she wouldn't get caught even. I guess she just, like, because... She views the camp as a bad place, so like, she wants to keep people from there, so whenever they show up, she murders them. I don't know.
Yeah, other than that point, she's crazy. It suffices, right, yeah. as her reason at that point.
Like, we don't need to break it down in a sufficient way to, other than, she's crazy. I get that. So she dies at the end, like, one of the most iconic death scenes. Were you guys scared of that at all? Like, her head getting chopped off, did that make you go, ooh, at all? Growing up, do you remember?
No,
not that I recall.
Like, I think I remember even as a kid going like, that looks really fake. Like, that doesn't look very good at all. Her head sort of like Because you catch it mid-swing. Like, you catch it already having been hacked off, so it just, like...
Yeah, it just goes slipping around.
Yeah, like, as she hits it, it's like she knocks the head off, because the head's already detached. So it has no, like, effect.
So, don't lose your head about this.
So
I know, I've already made the joke once, but I just wanted to, like, Alice...
Let's go back to that.
Highlander joke?
You really lost your head.
So...
That was my Christoph Lambert accent.
The one thing I will say that I had a hard time watching growing up was the scene in the lake. That always scared the shit out of me. Like, it was that scene, and like I've said before, the opening to Ghostbusters, as a kid, I could not watch those two scenes. They terrified me. So I always covered my eyes when I watched the very end of Friday the 13th.
Large Marge, still the scariest thing I've
seen. Large Marge.
That too. That would be three. I would add that to three. So that scene, like when he leaps out of the lake, I could not handle it. Like there was a combination of, I think, the tension and build up to that moment, and I knew it was coming, the dread. Just, I couldn't handle it. I had to look away. Especially the way that Jason's face looked.
And we can get a live reaction if you want to right now with Jackson. I'll show him that scene, see what he thinks.
You should. You should see if that scares him at all.
So you're going to ruin that and just show him that one scene.
Sure. He won't remember it. He'll be so scarred. He won't even want to sleep tonight.
See, I never had that problem. Like, movies never stayed with me as being scary, but in the moment, especially, like, there are very specific scenes I couldn't watch, and that was one of them. But it didn't stick with me. Like, once the movie was over, I was like, eh, whatever. But in the moment, I was like, I can't watch this.
I never had that problem. And for a while, it took me... I remember it took me a while to get the chronology of the movies right, and I never remembered what movie that was in, like that scene. But
yeah,
but they do they show it again in two, don't they?
At the beginning.
Yeah, that's the problem. It's in several.
Yes. Okay.
And because I mean, the second movie, like very creakily, opens with Alice. Like he has to. I guess it makes sense that he has to kill her because
she killed mom.
She killed his mom. It's just so weird that she's the first death. I mean, it makes sense.
It's just so weird that he's alive and grown up and has the skills of a Green Beret.
Right, and shows up at this random house.
Like, I mean, come on, guys. I mean, he's not... He died very young.
Yeah.
I guess the thing...
Go ahead.
Well, it just begs a whole rethinking of the entire thing also. Is he even dead, and is she avenging anything, or did she just raise her, you know, retarded son after he had a near-death experience in the lake?
Or did he survive and was just so afraid that he ran away? Like, and that's how he convalesced, was by living in the woods by himself. I don't know. Like, that's interesting. That would be an interesting sort of like retconning of that series.
Maybe that's where we need to base the prequels in, is the Jason, the learning years.
That would be
the wonder years.
The wonder years.
So
what would you do if drowned in a lake?
So do we recommend this movie? Like, is this something that we do with
course.
These? Like, do
if
we?
You haven't seen it, you've got to watch it.
But I'm saying, like, do we do recommendations for these very, like, very obviously classic movies?
Well, if someone hadn't seen it, yes, definitely.
Yeah, and I would say that if you're a fan of horror, it's almost like, you know, you have to. In the four movies we're talking about, those are four movies you have to see. Now you don't have to like them, but you have to see them.
They are cultural touchstones.
Yeah, or else you won't be respected in any conversation you try to get into.
Oh, I don't watch those type of movies.
But have you seen it? Yes. Although that's all I said. I don't care if you don't watch this type of movies. Like I imagine someone who hasn't watched this movie sit and you say, "Oh, what kind of like scary movies do you like? Like classic ones? Scream." you're out. So I would definitely say this has to be watched. Fucking watch all of them.
Yeah. Just binge watch. Tis the season. Watch all of them.
Oddly enough, these aren't on Netflix.
No, the seventh one is.
Part seven is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is one
awful,
that
awful. Awful.
It is.
But no Nightmare. No Texas Chainsaw. No. Halloween's.
Because they know you should own them.
Yeah. It is terrible. The seventh one is, but I probably watched that one the most growing up because it was always on USA. The seventh one, like, with
all night.
It was always.
That's
on.
The one where they have like a what? She's like a she has like
psychic powers.
Abilities.
Yes.
Oh God.
Yeah. Seven and eight get real weird.
Eight's fun though.
That's Jason Takes Manhattan, right?
Yeah, that's fun.
That's a good one. I like the one with the guy. They catch the guy who's trying to catch Jason. He does the, now when you say Jason Voorhees, I think of something different. I think of a little girl sticking a hot dog through a donut.
Is that Jason Goes to Hell?
Yes. The one where he comes back to life. Oh, right. The guy eating the heart.
Yeah. That's, yeah. What is that actor's name? Who is that? That's
he's in X-Files. I know that.
Oh, crap. I'm blanking on
the name. He was the chief in 21 Jump Street as well, the TV show.
Oh, what was his name? Damn it. Anyway.
Yeah, I know exactly who you mean. I can't think of his name now.
I also like the sort of meta, like, Jason Goes to Hell beginning that everyone knew.
Yeah.
Like that yeah. They were taking him down on purpose. I like that. Right. I like that intro.
The staged girls taking the showers and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That's good. All right, guys. We done?
I think so.
Yeah, well,
I thought I heard music, but
I kind of hear music, so I'm going to go ahead and end it.
Let's do it. Is that
Thanks for listening, guys. I'm Brian.
I'm Tyler.
And I'm Drew.
And we'll see you next time.
Horrible Podcast.
Happy October.
Woo! Shocktober.
Right, Dance Film Festival.